Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are the Democratic congressional candidate in the 3rd District of Wisconsin after a big win on Tuesday, Rebecca Cook, and the author of the 2024 presidential election autopsy, Paul Rivera. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Smalls, AquaTrue, 3-Day Blinds, and HERS WL in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors because it really helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James, a big primary day this week. On balance, good for the Democrats. The Trump-Republican narrative that the Democrats are dominated by socialists and communists, you got to go to a theme park in Cuba to find a communist, was dealt a blow when the Democratic socialist candidate for governor of Wisconsin was upset by a mainstream moderate. That's good for Wisconsin because they can now potentially win the general election, and good for other Democratic candidates. It's going to make it much harder to smear them with a false label. But, you know, MAGA already is charging. Look, leftists won in other races yesterday. Let's just take a look. In Connecticut, longtime Democratic Congressman John Larson, 78 years old, was beaten by 47-year-old Luke Bronin. Bronin is a former mayor of Hartford, a former assistant United States Treasury Secretary who served in Afghanistan. That race was about age, not ideology. In Minnesota, Matt Little won. He's a liberal who had the endorsement of the Democratic Farm Labor Party. Somehow, whatever the establishment is, I don't think he's anti-establishment. AIPAC poured, the pro-Israeli lobby poured millions into one of the candidates he beat. And AIPAC is really a pro-Netanyahu Republican lobby, and there I think they could be lethal for most Democrats. You don't even want their support. And in Minnesota, the Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, the more liberal candidate, won the Senate primary. I interviewed Flanagan some years ago. To be sure, she's a liberal. She is not a radical socialist. These candidates all fall into what, you know, I've called the Pelosi progressives, and they're all going to win in November. The idea that the far left is taking over the Democratic Party is just simply not true. Briefly, on the Republican side, Trump's clout may be slipping. He endorsed the crazy pillow guy in Minnesota who got clobbered. And in South Carolina, Lindsey Graham's sister, who is a creature of Trump, her candidacy is a creature of Trump, faces a tough runoff in 12 days, and history suggests she's going to have a hard time.
Well, Al, that was a very good recap. I don't have much to add to it. To me, the thing that struck me again is the giant polling fail. I'm talking about polling fail, double-digit polling fail in Wisconsin, a double-digit polling fail in Michigan, a double-digit polling fail in a New Jersey governor's race. I mean, all right, there are two primaries, but you're not supposed to miss by that much. And I wonder, and I'm texting back and forth with a couple of people, and does the left come out with all the enthusiasm, and then the more centrist voters that they tend to wake up closer to election? I don't know, but we've had some massive polling fails here. I mean, really big.
Well, I think you're right. I think that's what happens. I think, I just from what I've read, I wasn't in Wisconsin, that closing days when it became apparent that, Ms. Hahn was going to win, according to the polls, I think a number of liberal Democrats said, wait a minute, do we really want this? Do we really want probably to lose in November? And it was a great, she was a wonderful candidate to send a message, but not to send a candidate.
Without the Thanksgiving quote, she would have won. I think the Thanksgiving, sometimes it's, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back or whatever.
Right.
The slang. I think the Thanksgiving quote just had legs, and it cost her the race.
And her refusal in an interview with Caitlin Collins to revise it, to retract it, to take it back. I mean, yeah. She really more or less stuck with it.
she probably ran pretty much as to who she was.
Yeah.
And she certainly wasn't tempered by any middle-of-the-road political construct or anything. But the other thing is, too, she got an awful lot of votes, and as did Al Saeed. And there's something that's gone on underneath in the Democratic coalition. And all we did last night, I think, is dodge a bullet. But you think it's more economic than it is anything else. But the Gaza stuff is a much bigger problem than we want to own up to, because it's just power exercising raw power, and Israel is viewed as exercising power against hopeless people. That is a whole other side of the story, for sure, but it's among a large number of Democratic voters, it's turned into a big issue.
James, I don't disagree with you, but I think it also has something to do with candidates put up by the other side. El Saeed's victory in Michigan was impressive. He ran against a really poor candidate. And the Wisconsin Democratic Party, you know, we have always said, and I still say, Ben Wicker was one of the greatest party chairmen ever. But the governor, Tony Evers, this is a state that has a lot of really interesting, bright people, but somehow they can't find them when it comes time to run a candidate for senator governor. They should have beaten Ron Johnson last time. Instead, they ran a deeply flawed candidate. And this time, three candidates dropped out. And they had to pull this guy who won back in the last couple of weeks. This is a party that does a great job of organizing, do a great job of taking on Supreme Court races. They got to do a better job of finding candidates.
Well, yeah, and they didn't have a very good candidate to run against Ron Johnson. I mean, we've had a good enough candidate to beat maybe the worst candidate of the cycle. I mean, David Crowley was just, his main qualification to a lot of people was, well, he wasn't her.
That's right.
But in a state like that, that has that much Democratic talent, we sure don't get it in the game very much. And I don't know, maybe the governor just is, he's a little bit older, maybe he's just kind of lost interest. That would have never happened in Illinois. J.P. Pritzker would not
happen. Or it wouldn't have happened in Pennsylvania.
No, I
think that's an important point. I think Tammy Baldwin is a good candidate. There are exceptions to that. But, you know,
she came up a while back.
Yeah, she did. But, losing to Ron Johnson again in 2022 after he's been there for 12 years and often made a fool of himself was really inexcusable, and having to have a last minute rescue in this campaign says something, I think, about Tony Evers. You're right.
It just does. And for a state that does so many things right, in a Democratic Party that does so many things right, the most important, and this sounds so repetitive and so obvious, but it has to be repeated again. In any campaign, the most important entity, well, is the candidate. It's not the field operation. It's not the ads. It's not the talking points. It's not rapid response. It's not even fundraising. It's the candidate. And somehow or another, we tend to lose sight of that.
James, in 1992, do you think the candidate was more important than the campaign manager in that presidential race?
Well, I'd be honest with myself, you know. I think Secretariat had more to do with it than Ron Turcotte. I could have probably just hung on that and won it anyway. But it's always a good idea to remind yourself candidates matter. And I one of the things I'm most proud about this podcast, and we're going to do it again today, is people just don't understand, and you can understand why they don't. Just the talent level that's out there, and all we can put up is Haley Stevens. Come on, guys, we got to be able to do better than this.
Yeah,
you know,
we are one of the very few places, if not the only place, that is really focusing on House challengers. Now, people do know the Senate challengers. They know Roy Cooper, and they know even Josh Terrick or Teller. But the House candidates and the ones we've had on, you're right, there is such talent there. James, let me focus for a minute on Abdul El-Sayed in Michigan. There was a very important column by Tom Friedman in the New York Times on Tuesday, urging El-Sayed to articulate a position that is pro-Israel, anti-Netanyahu, pro-Zionist state, pro-separate Palestinian state, and dealing forcefully with the settlers. I think that's the best, would be the best outlook for the region, and it would certainly be the best outlook politically. I have a suspicion that some leftists couldn't do that. I think El-Sayed, from what I hear, can. And I think he doesn't have to give up any principles. I think he just has to do a better job of reaching out and disassociating himself from some of the, whatever they call them, anti, well, they're influencers, and they clearly are anti-Israel influencers. But he doesn't have to sacrifice his principles or beliefs to win that race. Tom Friedman gave him some awfully good advice the other day. I hope he read the column. And he's running against Mike Rogers, who was once a moderate Republican who condemned Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election. And now has changed, seeking Trump's approval. He suggests the 2020 election may not have been legitimate, a proven falsehood. An election denier, James, I think you would agree, is a far greater threat to democracy than someone who wants to ban firecrackers on the 4th of July.
Yeah, understand what Tom Friedman said is nothing but the Barack and Bill Clinton plan. So let's not kid. That's exactly anything in the Middle East starts and ends with that. Everything that he said is that.
It's just the context of El-Sayed and today.
Yeah. But all El-Sayed has to do, and he can, and it's the only way there's ever going, if there is ever going to be peace there, it is only under those circumstances. I guess there's some way somebody can get annihilated, but short of annihilation, just the only path to having anything like a reasonable peace there. And he could. And I agree with you. He's uniquely situated to say we have a roadmap in front of us. And this roadmap would be good for the Palestinian people, would be good for the Israeli people, would be good for the entire region, be good for the world. Get on with it.
He is clearly a leftist on policy. But I talked to someone who spent time talking to him on healthcare policy, a guy we both respect, who said he's a very thoughtful guy. This is not like those candidates who won House seats in Manhattan and Philadelphia and Denver. Yeah. There's going to be a lot of mud thrown at him. But I think you're going to find that El-Sayed may be a better and more reasonable left-wing candidate than people have supposed.
You know, we people tend to do something. And maybe sometimes I tend to do this, and it's really offensive, is we take all these left-wingers and we just, they're all amalgamated the same. There's real differences. I'll give you a real difference. Somebody on this show that we've long admired and admire more even today is AOC.
Absolutely.
I mean, AOC is more talented than the rest of the squad put together by factor 10. But if you just lump her in, with everybody else, El-Sayed is actually way more ability and thought than a lot of these just reflexive anti-Israeli politicians. I mean, there's something to the guy, and hopefully he and people like AOC can forge a good coalition. At least I'm hopeful.
You know, I wrote a column this week saying AOC was the most impressive of all of the left wingers, but she couldn't win in a swing district or swing state. I'm not totally sure of the latter yet. I still think that, but she is one impressive. She now is, and I'm going to say this, she's what I consider one of the Pelosi progressives. And Pelosi basically said that this week.
She said that. Jonathan Morton in Sacramento.
This is really, when Nancy Pelosi is with you, I'm with you. I think AOC has grown a great deal, again, without sacrificing any of her principles. James, what are your thoughts, if any, on the South Carolina situation with Lindsey Graham's sister?
I talked to some people last night. She's got a hard go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Trump's number, again, most I think the most undercovered story in American politics today is Trump's Republican number. It's like, and it's falling. I mean, it's falling quickly. I think it's coming in about 80 now in most polls, which is significantly lower than 95. And the country is so hard after being so obsessed with Trump for so long, for the last 10 years, it's been Trump, 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 Trump. The country is starting to turn away from him. Sure, his polling numbers are down, but he's just becoming less relevant in people's minds. And I think that applies to Republican primary voters in South Carolina. I think every day his endorsement loses a tenth of a point's influence.
Well, it sure did in Minnesota yesterday, and I think August 12th.
Feel it. He just doesn't. There, you know, even the Trump MAGA people, I mean, they're becoming less attached. They really are.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, a big day for Democrats on Tuesday.
Feed your cat right with Smarts. Cats are more reflect their diet than I think any other kind of small animal is. And well, when they have a bad diet, you put them on a good diet, it changes right away. Changes the way they act, their coat, how healthy their coat is. It makes a lot of difference.
You know, and cat lovers can't say enough great things about Smalls. Like a lot of people used to think the cat kibble in the grocery store was the way to go. But once you find out that's mostly filler, corn, and unpronounceable ingredients, you're going to know that cats deserve better. And once you switch to Smalls, they have a lot more energy, their fur feels softer, and more luxurious also. Smalls Fresh Cat Food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free 100% human-grade ingredients you'd find in your fridge, delivered right to your door. In addition to James, they have a ton of outstanding reviews. One that stood out said that, quote, Smalls has been the best decision I have made for my cat. He absolutely loves the food. His coat is shiny, and he licks the bowl clean, end quote. You're not surprised. Cats use protein as their main energy source, and more protein means more fuel and sustained energy. Smalls Fresh, gently cooked, preservative-free cat food gives them high protein and improved hydration for strong bones and toned muscles. Plus, a balanced diet leads to less shedding, fewer hairballs, better digestion, and more silky shine. Smalls is so confident your cat will love Smalls that they'll refund you if they won't eat it. So stop serving your little cat a bowl of processed shortcuts for a limited time. Because you're a Politics War Room listener, you'll get 60% off your first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/war room. One last time. Now listen, because this is really something. That's 60% off your first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/war room. The link is in our show notes. Hey, James, our guest is Rebecca Cook, who yesterday won the Democratic nomination in Wisconsin's 3rd District to take on MAGA Republican Derek Van Orden in the fall. It is one of the Democrats' top priorities. She barely lost to Van Orden last time and hopes to turn it around this time. Rebecca Cook, you're really kind of at the epicenter of what people call the Democratic split between the mainstream and the left. Mm. You soundly defeated a left-wing opponent yesterday, while Wisconsin, in a very close race, rejected a Democratic socialist. Mm-hmm. Do you think the party is going to have, these factions will have trouble uniting statewide and in the 3rd District this fall?
No, I don't. And I think, you know, I've worked to build a broad coalition of support. You know, I have the endorsement of folks like Senator Bernie Sanders, but I'm also a blue dog and a new Dem. And I think that, you know, that's what has made our campaign so strong. We're bringing together factions of the party. It can't be about purity. We've got to be focusing on electoral wins if we want to win back the House majority and actually move the ball down the field, right? And so that's, you know, today is day one. It's 83 days away from the general election. And I'm focused on defeating Derek Van Orden. And I know folks that maybe went with my opponent, Emily Berge, in the primary. I know that those folks are going to come together with me to focus on what our common goal is. And she ran a great campaign. You know, my primary opponent did, and worked to get out across 19 counties. And I'm excited to work with those people. I think there's a lot of shared vision. And it's like, I think that's the sort of thing is between like progressive moderate wings. People want to put you in a box, but, you know, I'm sort of Team Wisconsin 3 first.
Well, let me, I don't want to put you in a box, but you say you're a blue dog and you're a new Democrat. Tell me what it means to be a blue dog Democrat.
Yeah, I think they are folks that are fiscally conservative, socially liberal, are really working from like a place-based perspective. They're people that understand rural Democrats, working class Democrats that are showing up in rural communities and working class spaces that historically our party has left behind. And that's like, I think why I was connected with them originally, or why I, you know, what they were doing resonated with me so much. When I met Mary Peltola, with her background in Alaska, and Marie Glusenkamp-Perez, Jared Golden, like, those folks understand how to talk to people in rural America, where I feel like a lot of folks in the Democratic Party don't anymore. And I certainly do. I think we've built strong coalitions across this district with farmers, you know, healthcare workers, people in rural communities that feel really left behind.
Right. You've said that in Congress, Republicans are too right wing and congressional Democrats are too left wing. Specifically, how is Hakeem Jeffries too left wing?
I mean, I'm talking just, I think, in general. When I talk, I did an ad last cycle where I was standing in the middle of the road on my parents' farm, talking about how folks in D.C. are either too far left or too far right. We need more people in the middle that want to work across the aisle to get things done. I'm somebody that wants to work in a really bipartisan way and not put, you know, party before people or politics before people. And I think that's what's important. I think if we win back the House majority this fall, which I'm hopeful that we do, you know, I want to see things a little bit different than business as usual. We will have a new speaker in Hakeem Jeffries. I'd like to see committee assignments not just be sort of like a good old boys club of who's been there the longest, but thinking about who might be best suited to lead some of those committees, which is not typically how committee assignments are done in the Democratic Party. It's based on seniority. And I think institutional knowledge is important, but I think that we have a lot of young, fresh faces that are coming to Congress that are ready to move the ball forward on things that we've been waiting too long for from career politicians.
Yeah, you sure do that. You know, we've seen this movie before in the Wisconsin State Supreme Court race, but I saw the other day that Elon Musk just made a big contribution to your opponent, Derek Van Orden. Is that about data centers? Is that about what?
Yeah. I mean, look, like Derek Van Orden is in the pocket of big tech and in the pocket of AI, you know, billionaires, millionaires. I've come out for a data center moratorium, and you know, we've got Meta trying to build a data center just down the road here in Menominee. There was a ton of local blowback. And I think, you know, for Van Orden to prioritize and carry water for tech billionaires versus thinking about what local communities are asking for, it just shows like who he's out there for. Data center moratorium is just press and pause. I mean, we know AI is a part of, you know, the future, but, you know, Van Orden has been posting deep fakes of me on his Twitter, right? And like, we don't want to use AI for slop like that. We want to see it in medical research, things like that. And I think it just underscores sort of the type of person that he is. And yeah, he's carrying water for big tech companies. I want to make sure that we're protecting ratepayers, that people aren't seeing their utility rates go through the roof because a data center comes to their community. I want to make sure we're thinking about the environment and about long-term job creation and just how our local communities are protected in that process. And that's sort of the way that big tech and these data centers have been coming in. It's been shrouded in secrecy. There's not a lot of transparency. It's just like folks are coming in and taking what they want from rural America. And that's why I've stood up to say, I think we need a moratorium. We got to press pause until we understand more about this.
James Carville.
So, I observe the Republicans and the congressmen and different people, and they're all varying degrees of hideous. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, just from a distance, that Van Orden, in addition to his ideological insanity, is a personal jerk. Okay,
yes.
That's the way he comes across to me. It's just he's not the kind of person that you would want to hang out with. You wouldn't want to double date with.
You might want to bring him to a bar fight, but that's probably about it. You know,
about it. He doesn't come across a very nice man.
He's not.
I mean, I know somebody's Wisconsin Republicans, Rince Privates is a nice enough guy. Even Scott Walker,
Tommy Thompson,
nice
very nice guy.
Tommy Thompson's a glad hander.
Yeah.
I mean, a guy would sit down and, we could sell you an insurance policy.
I'm chatting with Tommy Thompson.
This guy just comes across to me is, frankly, an asshole. I mean, a giant one. He rises to a different level almost.
He is. And I mean, he's so far right. He's so out there. You know, he was at the insurrection. He's gotten drunk in his official office, yelled at Senate pages, loaded a gun through TSA. He won't host in-person town halls. And I think that has to do a lot with his temper and the fact that when he's pushed on votes that he's taken or the way that he's behaved, he can't control himself.
So tell us about the district. I mean, those of people who are kind of familiar with the geography of Wisconsin.
It's gorgeous, is what I'll say. It's 19 counties all along the Mississippi River border to Minnesota. A lot of rolling hills, the Driftless region. There's a little bit of a funky part of it that goes into central Wisconsin, where our cranberry producers are. We're the biggest cranberry producers in the entire country. I don't know if you guys know that, but we produce the most cranberries in the United States.
Learn something new every day. We sure do.
Well, and those folks were undercut in a big way by reciprocal tariffs and the impact that's had to their markets in China and in India. And there's a lot of people that are pissed off by Trump and Van Orden being big proponents to this and what that's done to undercut their bottom line. Over into Eau Claire, which is where I'm from, we've got 6 UW campuses across this district. Eau Claire has one of them. A lot of rural hospitals across this district that have been, for now, able to remain open, independent. But we'll see what happens this fall with the impact that the reconciliation bill is going to have on keeping those hospital doors open. Very agricultural community. I grew up on a dairy farm in this district here, just outside of Eau Claire in the town of Wheaton. Grew up showing cows in 4-H from the time I could walk and hold a halter. And that's a big part of our heritage here in Wisconsin. A lot of farms have gone under, over the last couple of decades. It's not any one administration or any one Congress's fault. But nobody's really come in to sort of fix that. And that's a big reason why I decided to step up to run for Congress. When I was in high school, we had to sell our cattle because of the price of milk and competition with larger dairies, which was tough because our family is 6th generation. We've had a farm in this district for 150 years. So when you lose a business like that, it's a part of like your heritage and way of life, and it's tough. And nothing has come back through to replace that. And so you see such a deep impact on rural economies across this district. And what has come to replace agriculture and dairy farming? It was sort of like go big or go home. And, we weren't able to go big and our family didn't want to go big. I think there was this quality of life that really changes when you go from being a smaller mid-sized dairy to being, one that milks thousands of cattle.
Observation and question at the same time. I've said this view on this program many other times. However much Democrats overperform in the elections in 2026, and I think it's pretty clear that they're going to overperform. Mm-hmm. They're going to overperform by 10% more in agrarian-centric areas. Mm-hmm. That this administration policies have been particularly hurtful to the agriculture sector.
Absolutely.
And I think that there's a are you starting to see that among farmers and dairymen and people like this, that they're particularly aggrieved at some of these policies?
Well, they're pissed. I mean, I've been talking to people that are Farm Bureau members. I've been talking to people when I'm at county fairs or dairy breakfasts across this district. farmers uniquely are getting squeezed really every turn by this administration. You think about the impact that reciprocal tariffs have had for our soybean producers and our cranberry producers. Then you've got this war in Iran, which nobody voted for, right? This president and Dara Van Orden have campaigned on an America First agenda. This war in Iran was not that, right? We've seen increased fertilizer prices, increased diesel prices that have been hurting farmers. And then the failure to expand the ACA tax credit premiums. So, you know, we didn't have health insurance a lot of the time when I was growing up on the farm. Like if my mom got a good job in town, you know, we might get insurance for a period of time. So when the ACA came along, a lot of farmers, a lot of small business owners got better insurance really for the first time. But now people are seeing their insurance premiums go up from $400 to $1,800 a month. So farmers, between, you know, what their input costs are, between these tariffs and the reciprocal tariffs and the impact that's had on their bottom line, and then healthcare, I mean, they're just, it is just too hard to make it work. And it's been hard already, you know, and it just, this adds insult to injury. And I will say, I don't know if you folks know this, but over 10 cabinet officials from this administration have come to this district to campaign for Dara Van Orden, which I think is a terrible strategy for him, because I think people know who is to blame right now. When Republicans have the House, when Republicans have the Senate, and they have the White House, and people feel worse off, they know who's to fault for that. He brought RFK Jr. here to Elk Mound, which is very near Eau Claire. We have had two hospitals here in Eau Claire close. That was before the reconciliation bill. We've had labor and delivery close over Menominee, very nearby. RFK Jr. came here, didn't talk about what he was going to do for rural health care or, you know, to work to try to get some of these hospitals back open. He talked about moving milk to the top of the food pyramid. Totally out of touch with what people need here. In that same week, that was on Monday, on Friday, President Trump came to a farm 2 miles down the road from the house that I grew up on, or the farm that I grew up on. Not, you know, he was supposed to be talking about the things that he's done for farmers. He spent the whole time talking about his big ballroom, his big reflecting pool, you know, total slap in the face to these people that are struggling. And I've been talking to people that are, you know, three-time Trump voters, two-time Van Orden voters that are just, they're ready to come over, and we've got a big tent. You know, when I'm talking to people at parades, if I see someone with a MAGA hat on, I'm shaking their hand. So I outperformed in a big way in 24.
Rural health is not doing well at all.
No.
The agriculture sector is not doing well at all.
Uh-huh.
You know who really is doing well? People that make $1 million a year.
Yeah,
they're really doing well. And they made that choice that they were going to give everything in tax cuts, $3 trillion worth, and they were going to take it out of everything else. And that was a bad choice. And you want to go to Washington and reverse that choice.
I do.
Just remember, tax cuts for the wealthy, taxing the wealthy is consistently the most popular policy proposal in the United States. And it's not just liberals that like it. It's not just progressives that like it. It's not just everybody likes that policy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
You know, I have to say, Rebecca Cook, that those people, the cranberry capital of America, really must be pleased that Wisconsin didn't elect a governor who wants to ban Thanksgiving. That wouldn't have been good for the cranberry industry.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't had the gubernatorial election here yet. We have a Democratic nominee in David Crowley that I think a lot of folks are getting around and coalescing behind. And so, you know, he comes from a very much a working class background. And that's where I just think we need more working class people to run for office. I've been doing some work, actually. I'm a waitress. I've been a waitress since I was 16 years old. I've run a small business here in my community. But I also waitress to make ends meet. I did some fellowships last year also with the group called Third Way around, you know, how do we get more working class folks to run for office? How do we connect more with working class voters in general? And I'm proud of that work because I think there's this disconnect in the party. And when we run working class people, folks come out to vote because people trust those people, right? Folks trust me because I have some of those same lived experience that they've had, right? We've had to sell our cows because of the low price of milk. I've had to struggle to compete with the Amazons of the world in running a small business. I know what it's like to sign the front of a paycheck as well as the back of a paycheck, right? And I know what it's like to do hourly wage work. There's a lot of members of Congress that have never done those sorts of things. So when they're making policy that's impacting working families, they're out of touch with that. And I think the same is to say, I have somebody like David Crowley as the nominee for governor here. You know, he comes from a working class background too. And there's a lot of people I'm excited about across this country. People like Jamie Ager that's running for Congress in North Carolina.
He's been on the show.
Well, I love Jamie. Jamie's great. He's a beef farmer from down in North Carolina, understands right. those issues intricately. You know, I think about folks like, well, there's Blake up in northern New York who's running too, another dairy farmer. But like,
yeah.
You know, Marie Gleason-Camp-Perez, Jared Golden, like going back to some of those blue dogs, those are working class people. Those are people that have, you know, been a part. They're not just another doctor or lawyer in Congress. I think we got enough of those.
Let me ask you about your opponent. You mentioned rural hospitals earlier. Van Orden says that he is doing everything to prevent the closing of rural hospitals in Wisconsin. He also said he did not vote to cut Medicaid.
Yeah, that's a lie. He did. He voted for the one big ugly bill that's cutting Medicaid and SNAP benefits. The Rural Health Transformation Fund, which he talks a lot about, is just a drop in the bucket to what our rural communities actually need to keep our rural hospitals open and funded. It's $204 million for this state. You divide that between 72 counties, that's about $2 million. It's not enough of what folks used to have, right? I think that we've got to increase Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement rates for rural hospitals. Every time a patient that comes in is on one of those programs, they just hemorrhage money to see those patients. And I've met with rural hospital CEOs across this district. Derek Van Orden is just starting to do that in the last couple of weeks. I've been seeing him going out. We've been doing that over time since we saw that bill pass because we knew what the impacts were going to be. I've met with folks down in Richland Center, Mauston, all these different smaller communities. In Richland Center in particular, they've been trying to recruit an orthopedic surgeon for 3 years, and they don't have a single psychiatrist in the entire county. They just got an orthopedic surgeon, good news, which is I found out a couple of weeks ago. But, you know, hospitals are really struggling. And it's for us in this district, it's not just a cost issue, but it's an access issue. When people have to drive further and further to get the care they need. And, you know, and it's labor and delivery too. Like, if you want people to come back and raise their family in a rural community, there's got to be a labor and delivery unit there, right? My friend just had a baby here a couple of weeks ago. She lives in Menominee, which is 40 minutes from Eau Claire. She went into labor and had to drive to Eau Claire to have her baby because labor and delivery is closed in Menominee. Thanks to like Derek Van Orden.
That's, you know, I'm going to turn this over to James to close it up. Let me ask you a quick question. You mentioned waitressing. Are you still able to waitress during the campaign?
I'll be there Friday night and Saturday night. So, yeah.
So where will you be Friday night? Is it your restaurant?
It's not my restaurant. It's some folks. I've been waitressing there since the night that they opened back in 2022. So it's called The Good Wives. It's in Eau Claire. A couple of women own it. And yeah, and it's been, I love it. It's sort of like when you're waitressing, it's kind of like knocking doors. You know, you're talking to people all the time. They're like, oh my God, I can't believe you're here. And I was like, yeah, I don't just play a waitress on TV. I have to earn a living while I'm running for office. And I think that's what's really hard and that's sort of why I've leaned on some of these fellowships too that I've done, is it's just like, it's hard to be able to work full time, pay your rent and, you know, show up in communities in the way that you're demanded to as a candidate. So.
Okay, James, Friday night dinner with us in Eau Claire.
Sure,
you ready?
Night. Can you get me a brew and a brat?
A brew and a brat?
Yeah.
We don't have that there, but we will have you come and have a brew and a brat.
Okay.
We've also got lutefisk lunches. We've got all sorts of stuff that you guys can come out to. There's a few more county fairs left in the season. So there's a lot of good things to eat out here. It's not just cheese curds, but we love our cheese curds.
I think you're going to have a terrific election come November. And my only advice from 30,000 feet is there's so many hideous and odious things about this guy. You got to do triage. You just have to pick the two or three worst. And that means you got to leave another 30 on the table. But I mean, he is really a first class right winger. And he, more important, the guy's just a jerk. Don't forget that.
I will say, James, I know my enemy and I've run against this guy before. And I feel like we are prepared to take him down. So
good. Well, let's do this let's get this extraction done, girl.
Yeah.
Rebecca Cook, you have been a terrific guest. Congratulations on your big victory yesterday, and we will stay in touch.
Absolutely. Awesome.
I'm not sure we'll be in Eau Claire for the Saturday night dinner, but one of these times, okay?
One of these times. All right. Thanks so much, you too.
Drink the good stuff with Aqua True. Well, our partners have clean, safe water for your family. Let's put that under critically important.
May not have been the smartest question I've ever asked you, James.
We can agree. It's, you don't want your family to be drinking dirty water.
Right.
By the way, you don't have to even take a chance with this stuff. It doesn't matter. It'd make anything clean.
Right. I mean, and you got to know, 3 out of 4 U.S. homes have toxic chemicals in their tap water. I mean, that's really shocking. And it's not good for us. It's not good for your kids or your pets. Even though contaminated water looks clear, it could put you at a risk for devastating health concerns, including fatigue, hormone disruption, cognitive decline, even cancer. Despite what you may think, standard fridge and pitcher filters do little to remove most contaminants. And bottled water contains microplastics, which means you're just trading one problem for another. We know there had to be a solution out there, which is why we want to tell you about Aqua True. Aqua True is a top-of-the-line countertop water purifier tested and certified to remove 84 contaminants, including chlorine, lead, forever chemicals, and microplastics. It's a patent 4-stage reverse osmosis system that goes way beyond ordinary filters to give you pure, healthy water you can trust. Best of all, it doesn't need plumbing or installation. Don't just take our word for it. Aqua True has been featured in Business Insider, Popular Science, and named Best Countertop Water Filter by Good Housekeeping. So join 98% of customers who say their drinking water is cleaner, safer, and healthier. Go to AquaTrue.com now for 20% off your purifier. With promo code WARROOM, Aqua True even comes with a 30-day best-tasting water guarantee. That's AquaTrue.com. AquaTrue.com. Promo code WARROOM. The link is in our show notes. James, our guest is Paul Rivera, who was the author of the controversial autopsy of what went wrong for the Democrats in the 2024 election. It was commissioned by, his friend, or his once friend, DNC chair Ken Martin. Mr. Rivera, there is a very bitter back and forth between you and the chairman over whether the much maligned autopsy did or didn't include a chapter on the Biden decision not to seek reelection or Harris's shortcomings as a candidate. And about the well-heeled consultants, we can certainly get into all that. But first, let me just ask, factually, did you interview top people like Jen Dillon O'Malley and David Plouffe and others for this autopsy?
We interviewed 216 people as part of this process from across the country. The campaign decided to curate a list and gave it to us, and those names were not included. We worked with people from the campaign. We did interview some people from the campaign they didn't have on their list, but we did not interview 3 of the top leaders, the manager, the chair, or Mr. Plouffe. They decided not to participate.
It's interesting. They didn't want to they didn't want to participate. You know, I was perplexed when the original document omitted the Biden question. I mean, there are interesting questions about Monday morning quarterbacking TV advertising versus digital, Joe Rogan, et cetera. But it seems to me it's all dwarfed by Biden's decision not to run again at age 81. That set the tone for the entire campaign, including when he eventually was forced to drop out. And Harris, I mean, that if you historians look back at 2024, that will be the main story. Don't you agree?
Well, I think that's been settled by the fact that he ultimately did not run. And in large part, the data that was in front of them, as I included in the Blue by 32 report, shows in their own polling his approval never passed 43%.
Yeah, but he stayed in until July.
Yeah, and again, incumbent presidents, it's their prerogative to seek office. Anybody who wants to run for office in this country can. He made the decision to do it. And, you know, the party leadership, party establishment, for the most part, they're going to defer to an incumbent. And they did. Out of loyalty, out of respect, they did what they did. Now, ultimately, when he had the debate performance and it became clear that his, you know, was no longer viable, he did make the right decision and step back both for the good of the party and what he thought was the good of the country. And, you know, we had 107 days with a new candidate to try to make it all work, and it didn't happen. So in large part, the findings of this report actually are less about the president and more about the systemic failures within the party over time, which put us in a position where we should have been able to elect someone with 107 days.
Yeah, well, I don't
days.
Disagree with I that, mean, but would you disagree that if Biden had kept to what he originally said he was going to do and serve as a transition, a bridge, and in, say, September of 23 said, I'm not running for re-election, there was an open primary, that would have been much better for the party, whatever the outcome?
Well, it's an unknown. It's possible. It's
likely.
Well,
of course it's an unknown, but...
Well, of course it's an unknown, and we don't have a time machine, right? So the ability to go back and change those things, in many ways, is less relevant than understanding that the flaws within the party infrastructure and the systemic failures within the party are what led us to the loss. We should have been able to elect Joe Biden with all of his failings. We should have been able to elect Kamala Harris. We were not able to. And worse, we lost to a felon, right? Losing to John McCain or losing to Mitt Romney is one thing. When you lose to Donald Trump with everything that is known about him, it should really wake you up and understand that the party's weaknesses are actually bigger than the candidate choices.
Well, I guess I disagree. I think the candidate made that choice. And with another candidate, it might have been a different outcome. But you're right. We'll never know that. I also want to talk about Kamala Harris. And I think she does, you know, you hear criticism about Harris's campaign. Some people say that trans ad was really devastating. I think, in fact, research shows the most devastating ad was quoting Kamala Harris as saying she believed in Bidenomics. And if she had gone, not in The View in October, at that convention and said, look, I am very proud to have served with Joe Biden for the last 4 years. We accomplished a lot of good. We do have, you know, several differences, including on affordability for most Americans. And here's my plan. It would have infuriated the Biden people, but it certainly would have put her in a better position for the next 2.5 months.
Yeah, I think that both at the time and retrospectively, And the vice president wrote about this herself. I think that there was a clear need to create more distance with the president and with the status quo. This was a change environment and a change electorate, and people wanted something different. I think that for us, looking at what the Republicans did for the last 3 weeks of the campaign, they put all of their money into two ads. It was the transgender spot, and the other one was her appearance on The View, where she said she couldn't think of a thing she would change.
Right.
Now, they look at data differently than we do, but this isn't rocket science. They decided to run an ad using her own words, saying that she was not a change agent. And that is in many ways, when you get to late deciders and how people make decisions at the close of an election, there was not enough of a difference between her and the president to create an effective contrast and offer people something that would look like a good change for them and their families moving forward.
Yeah, I agree. I think by the time she did The View in early October, it may have been too late. I think the missed opportunity was really at that convention in August. But
she did draw a contrast. She said she would appoint the Republican to the cabinet. She did talk about differences in foreign policy.
Yeah, but
by the time she gets on The View at the close, again, a lot of this, and both of you gentlemen know this, elections are decided by a very small group of people at the very close of a campaign. By the time you get to The View 3 weeks out, 90%+ of Americans already decided who they're voting for, right? So when you do that in a crystallizing moment and then the Republicans take it and turn it into an ad, you should realize that that was a mistake and that was something that hurt you.
Yeah, her really introductory moment was at that convention, but I don't want to stay on that. You know, you talk about...
By the way, Mr. Hunt, that was a great convention and she did a really good job. She delivered
Nothing stuck with her.
No, we look back at that and say, well, she could have done more, should have done differently. But the campaign isn't decided in a single moment, right? So over those 107 days, you have to stack up wins and you have to have positive outcomes. what happened in Chicago was positive. You got to build from that and build on that. And it looks like this campaign did not do that well enough to be able to
close. You have to have something at a convention to build on, and she had very little to build on. That was a fundamental problem, I think.
Well,
but
okay.
You talked about
the
systemic—
I disagree on that because I think she did a damn good job there. And I think the convention overall was one of those things where it was very high stakes, and people came in saying, who is this person? What are they doing? And I think they came out of that with enough answers. And I think many in the media understood that. I think that the challenge became over time, how are you continuing to build? And that's where I think they came up short.
Well, you know, we're not going to agree on this because I think she didn't set the predicate she could have set. You talked about the systemic problems, which I guess basically is a Democratic brand. That is a tough, that's a liability tough to overcome.
It is. And I think that the systemic problems when we talk about in terms of how money is raised, the way in which we communicate, the way we don't organize the way we used to, and how we spend money has resulted in that brand. Right. So we talk at the close of this about a very small group of people who control the money, control how investments are made. And then what do we end up with? A broken brand, losses across the federal ballot, and a real loss with a lot of younger people who don't have a connection to this party. And I think that reversing that requires us to really be honest about the nature of those problems and taking steps to fix them.
James.
So, Ms. Verb, tell us, give us 60 seconds on your career, your professionalism, about your career as a political consultant, because most people don't know that, and you came to this big assignment, and give us a little bit about your background.
Well, I started, my first job in politics was at the 92 convention, working for Michael Pitts in the Department of Transportation over there, running the staff motor pool. And then my brother worked on the campaign doing advance, and he pulled me in. And one thing led to another, and I ended up working for the Clinton administration for 6 years, doing advance work and other special projects over time. And then after that loss in 2000, kind of went back to New York, focused on New York politics, but worked on the Kerry campaign in 04, where I ran the political department day to day in the general election. Left presidential politics at that point, again, focusing on New York, spent a lot of time in the state legislature and working down ballot, working on a lot of independent expenditures, and every 4 years coming back and helping with the convention on everyone except the one in Milwaukee. So keeping close to the party and trying to bring some of that out of Beltway innovation into some of the ecosystem that drives so much for us.
So I wanted to establish that because you were really qualified to do this. This is my central question. But let's start Labor Day. We can't, Biden should have gotten out September 23. It was like screaming at the top of my lungs. So was out. The show was consistently the entire time Biden should run. Whatever the opportunities were here or there. But I see it between Labor Day and Election Day. I think the Harris campaign had control over $2 billion. I mean, they were swimming in money.
Yes.
To my knowledge, they didn't get a single vote on Election Day. They weren't getting on Labor Day.
It's possible and likely.
You're going back, or you were doing that. What could they have emphasized? What could they have done to build on the 48% that they started with?
I don't think there's much you can do in the last 60 days in that case, right? That you shouldn't have been doing while you had the White House for 3 years. And in 2002, we won in the midterms, overperformed, if you will. And the team inside the DNC did a report saying, here's some things that we need to do in terms of fixing our organizing infrastructure, getting ready for a reelect. They wrote a very detailed plan, and none of it happened on schedule, and some of it didn't happen at all, right? And when your team is telling you, here's what we need to do, and you don't heed some of those lessons, you end up in a situation where you're going into Labor Day and you're standing up programs after Labor Day. They contacted, and again, I have this in the report on organizing, they contacted a supermajority of the voters directly after Labor Day, not before. So this campaign was literally showing up in the last month with somebody who nobody had voted for in a primary, with whom most Americans did not know. They can't name the vice president today, much less who the vice president was 4 years ago, 2 years ago. So they put themselves behind the eight ball because they hadn't done the work beforehand. And in many ways, part of what we're showing in this, all the data, it's an ocean of data, it's 564 pages, it's a lot of information, was that the campaign wasn't really positioned to reelect the president, much less take the vice president and then try to elect her. And again, you've been in presidential campaigns, Mr. Hunt, you've covered them for a long time. It's supposed to be the closing crescendo. It's not supposed to be, hey, what are we starting with now? What are we trying to accomplish now? And it didn't happen. Right. So so when you think about, do you really understand who your voters are? Do you understand what messages need to connect with them? When you think about the surrogacy and the programs that you need to run, all of that has to be done before Labor Day. Labor Day should just be pure execution forward. And they were making it up. They weren't making it up as they were going along. They were trying to rebuild it at 30,000 feet, going down fast towards Election Day. And it was very hard for them to accomplish. So give them grace a little bit, just given the circumstances. But the truth is they had 3.5+ years before the president dropped out to build a better operation. And it didn't happen.
So basically, just to get what you're saying, it was lost on Labor Day. There wasn't much you could have done differently to get another point.
There's always mistakes that happen after Labor Day. There's always opportunities that get missed after Labor Day. Look, there's a lot of different ways to look at that particular election. And there's always things in an election, right? Trump, the shooting in Pennsylvania, right? The different dynamics that repolarize the election. His conviction should have killed him. It didn't. Like, what happened throughout this was very disruptive and very crazy. I think that the decision that the president made was likely the thing that sort of put us in a place where we're at 48% and never looking at 50 at any point in the polling.
So, I'm sure that'll be out. How much difference would a highly functioning, confident DNC, as opposed to just a lethargic DNC, how much difference could they really make? I don't know. How big do you think they are in Democratic campaigns and Democratic politics?
You know, there are some people who see the party as solely responsible for nominating a president and holding a convention, right? The charter of the DNC is much broader than that, and its mandate can be bigger. My first chair was Ron Brown, and what Ron Brown did to prepare the party to elect a president was necessary. What Terry McAuliffe did in building a national voter file, what Howard Dean did with the 50-state program. There's a lot of things that you can do when you're out of power to build towards power. And then when you have the White House, there's a lot you can do to strengthen the party and build massive infrastructure and bring significant change. And I think our last two presidents have kind of missed that opportunity. We did not do what we needed to do with President Obama. They actually defunded the 50-state program, moved a lot of programming out of the party and into Organizing for America, which helped his reelect. But then Secretary Clinton becomes a nominee with 104 days left and there's no infrastructure, right? We can look what President Biden had as an incumbent and what was not built. His own team saying, hey, let's go build these pieces that we need for the reelect, and they weren't done. So a functioning DNC, which we really haven't had for a very long time, is something that should be investing and building and researching and testing and being an innovation center that helps the party move forward. Now, I think this chair is trying to do that, but I think they're under-resourced and they need a better approach to getting that done. And we're sort of out of time, both for the midterms and for 28.
Yeah, I'll turn it back out.
The DNC is not the party. The party is bigger than that. And if people outside the Beltway, governors and mayors and so many other people who can carry a message and can deliver for people. And I think that the emphasis on this Beltway sort of stuff is a distraction. The truth is that systemically, we don't have enough trained and talented people in our ecosystem to run quality campaigns. When you look at what's happening between the left and the establishment and all this stuff, they're just running better campaigns right now, right, than the establishment is. They're kicking their ass in organizing. They're kicking their butt in terms of finding salient messages that people care about. And that's what's happening in many ways across the country. So if Democrats want to get their groove back, you got to start leaning more into this establishment framework of, we need to organize our way out of this hole. We need to draw better contrast with Trump and the Republicans. And we need to keep the focus like a laser on the things everyday people care about. And those are things that if you look at the last 2 weeks of media coverage, it's all been about Democrats fighting with each other. How about we actually keep the focus on the Republicans for the next 90 plus or less than 90 days now and go win some elections?
Dream on, man. Dream on.
Hey, we got to try.
Let me just tell you, Paul, you're wrong. We have interviewed Democratic candidates, House candidates, which don't get the attention from people like you and others, and from Kate Conley in New York to Jamie Agger in North Carolina to Janelle Stelson in Pennsylvania. They are not only great candidates, they're running great campaigns. They have a great political ecosystem. So I think what you say about the DNC is right, but I don't think the Democrats are devoid of either great candidates or of people who are helping those great candidates. You know, this year we're going to see a repeat, I think, of 2018, both in the outcome and the caliber of candidates running.
Well, I hope you're right. And in Blue by 2032, we do actually credit the House for running a very solid political operation, and the Senate, and the DGA, and DAGA. So yes, you're right. There are many bright spots that we can point to. I also hope you're right, because if we get 2018 outcomes, we'll be able to save freedom. My concern is that what we're seeing in primaries so far this year, with some exceptions, is generally speaking, huge groups of who should be our voters are not participating in our primaries. In what is frankly a crazy environment, an unprecedented set of circumstances, people are not as excited as they were in 2018. And I think we have to be clear about that as we're moving forward between now and the close of the election.
Boy,
I mean,
the
Virginia
numbers,
starts voting in 5 weeks. Like, what are we talking about?
The numbers don't substantiate that.
And no, they absolutely
some of the pollsters,
do.
Well, they don't. And the pollsters I've talked to say the enthusiasm is very similar to 2018.
No.
Well,
no,
I guess
no,
they do it
no,
for
Al,
a living.
Let me give you some clarity, just to be clear.
Yeah.
Like, polls are polls, and they're very important tools for us to measure things like enthusiasm and vote support, et cetera. Election returns are election returns. And when you look at actual election returns and you look at voter files and you look at who has voted and who has not, we are seeing very low turnout from Black voters, Hispanic voters, Asian voters, Native American voters, young voters. We are. There are a couple of exceptions.
Give me two examples.
Michigan. Like, I mean, again, very high turnout primary, but within that, it's disproportionately more white and older than it is non-white and younger. That was just last week. And you can look at, by the way, there's a couple of exceptions. North Carolina, right? Decent turnout, but again, very low young, very low Black. Contrast it with Georgia and North and Texas and Illinois, where Black women were running statewide, and you see higher Black turnout. But in many of these other places, and again, you can chart it, it's a fact. And Catalyst, by the way, is going to be doing a report on this shortly once all the primaries are over.
Who's going to be doing a report?
Catalyst. They do the report every cycle. So you're going to see this. And again, it's not the end of the world, just to be clear, if we do something about it. But how do you get out of some of these message gaps that we have with younger people? Create experiences and organize your way through that, and you have an opportunity. And the challenge that's before us is, are we trying to win an argument over direction of the party, or are we trying to win elections by drawing contrast with Republicans? And I think that in many ways, we need to do both, to be clear. The direction of our party will drive whether or not people want to work with us and support our candidates, right? But organizing is a big piece of that. And I think it's necessary for us to be honest about the weakness of our organizing infrastructure. It has to get
James,
better. I agree with a lot of you said. The Black turnout has been really good since college, to the extent that we know something.
In Alabama, I think
that Black turnout is going to be a big boost to us. But before I let you go, I have this idea. I wanted to do it this cycle, but it didn't get done. I'm trying to get American Bridge to put a 3-day boot camp, getting people in and just training them and talking about things. I just find our party doesn't have any infrastructure to bring people up. Whatever you learn, you got to learn it the way you and I learned it. You just learn it on the fly. You go to a bar at night and listen to somebody say something, and that makes more sense than that. And we don't do that. They do that a lot better than we do. Particularly these right-wing organizations. They train their people.
They do. And they invest a lot in young people, right?
So
the combination of what the Koch brothers, you know, the Koch organization has funded going back to 2010, Libre, et cetera, and they're in communities with offices for the last 10 years. The Turning Point efforts on high schools and college campuses and what they're doing with young people. And we're just like not even close to showing up for that. They're seeding a generation of activism and a generation of work that we're just not supporting. And I think those things have to happen. I think you're right about boot camps, the ability to explain to people what a vote goal is, right? And then how we have to go understand how to meet the component parts of that, understand this is a message. This is not.
Yeah, I got a framework.
Yeah, we got to teach people how to listen, how to learn, how to communicate, how to pull people in instead of just pushing information out.
If I get this thing green lit, I'm going to have you as a curriculum consultant to figure
tell
out
me
exactly.
Tell me what you want. We'll jump in and
what
help.
What are things we're going to do? All right, well,
Paul Rivera, thank you very much.
Thank you. Get your life right with 3-day bonds. To me, it's everything in the world. But night sleep is everything to me, and I got to sleep in a dark room. I just do. And the summer days are so long, if you forget about it when you go to sleep and the sun is coming in, waking you up at 5:30 in the whatever, some hideous time in the morning. So yes, this is very important.
You know, when you're upgrading your home, wandering around the store is exhausting, especially when the summer sun coming through your busted blinds wakes you up at 7 or 6 or 5 a.m. even. Spend your Saturday brunching, not blind shopping, because there's a better way to buy blinds, shutters, shades, and draperies. It's called 3-Day Blinds, the leading manufacturer of high-quality custom window treatments in the United States. And right now, if you use our URL, 3dayblinds.com/war room, they're running a buy one, get one 50% off deal. That's a heck of a deal. We shop for almost everything at home, so shop for blinds there, too. 3-Day Blinds, local professionally trained design consultants, average 10-plus years of experience in providing expert guidance on the right blinds for you, all in the comfort of your home. Just set up an appointment, and you'll get a free, no-obligation quote the same day. We love that expert team at 3-Day Blinds handles it all. Measuring and installing blinds can be a big challenge, so they design, measure, and install for you. That way you can sit back, relax, and leave the heavy lifting to the pros. Once you hear about them, you're going to know it was time to upgrade. Their blinds come in thousands of options that fit any budget or style, so it's an easy sell in the family. With 3-Day Blinds, you can be excited to getting better sleep and opening and closing motorized blinds from the comfort of your beds. Alexa, I slept great. Now let there be light. They are a real upgrade, not just a replacement, and we know you're going to like your 3-Day Blinds as much as everyone does. Right now, get quality window treatments that fit your budget with 3-Day Blinds. Head to 3dayblinds.com/war room for their buy one, get one 50% off deal on custom blinds, shades, shutters, and drapery. For a free, no charge, no obligation consultation, just head to 3dayblinds.com/war room. One last time, that's buy one, get one 50% off when you head to the number 3daiblinds.com/war room. The link is in our show notes. Hey, now for the outrage of the week. James, I'm not happy with this outrage, but it's real. Alani Bankhead is a very admirable person. After a 21-year distinguished career in the United States Air Force, she moved to Montana, where she won the Democratic Senate primary in June. Unfortunately, she has no chance to win the general election against a flawed Republican. But there's an independent candidate, former president of the University of Montana, Seth Bodner, who would have a shot, except Bankhead this week refused to bow out. That virtually hands the election to Kurt Almy, who got the Republican nomination by virtue of a dirty trick when the incumbent Steve Daines dropped out at the last minute, so the nomination could only go to one person. You've looked around the country and in Nebraska and in South Dakota and in other places. Democrats who knew they had no chance have dropped out for independents who do have a chance. The most important thing in November is to basically have a Democratic House and Senate to check Trump. This is not a normal election. This election is about Trump. And I think that Alina Bankhead made a mistake, and it saddens me.
I agree with you so much. I can't even tell you, and this woman, 21 years in the United States Air Force, the country is in imminent peril. We need to act like it. And this is what it takes to reduce that peril, to reduce the exposure of the United States to its entire future. Please look at this again. Take another look at it. And first and foremost, think about your country. So for my outrage, a friend of mine sent me this. I don't even know who the author of it is, but it's so good I'm going to read it. It's a fake article. It says, Trump to announce a major shift in priorities. January 19th, 2027, Associated Press. Donald Trump will, in a State of the Union address with Democrats in control of the House and Senate, who will now devote all of his time to his top priority, making money. The AP obtained a draft copy of his speech, which he declares. During the first year of my second term, I increased my wealth by $2 billion. It would have been much more, but I was distracted by the winning passage of the big, beautiful bill, picking winners in the GOP primaries and appointing more Republicans to the federal bench. In the second year, my war against Iran ate up too much of my time, lending my net gains to what looks like another $2 billion. Now the Democratic victories have freed me from all obligations, enabling me to abandon my role as leader of the world's superpower, as if you ever had it. I will devote myself to my top priority, leaving the presidency in 2029 at least $15 billion richer. There is a note in the margin at this point telling Trump to stop talking and allow Republican members of the House and Senate to stand up and applause, ideally for at least 6 minutes. Then Trump continues. Making at least $11 billion over the next 2 years may seem like a daunting task, but we have only just begun to explore new ways to convert the White House and all the powers that go with it to a cash-generating bonanza. I shouldn't say this, but Steve Miller will chair the Revenue Task Force privately, said privately to me, we should change the name of the White House to the Whorehouse. I added, just as long as everybody remembers we're the fuckers and everyone else out there are the fuckies. It's the greatest speech ever delivered. The greatest speech ever delivered. Hit your goals with hers. Most important thing that you can do, and I always ask people, you know, go to a nursing home, old folks home. You know what you don't see in there? Fat people. Yeah. So if you want to make it to the old folks home, you better keep, watch your weight. And weight loss is critical to that.
Well, I'm not crazy about necessarily going to the old folks home, but it sure as hell beats the alternative.
Yeah, it does. It might not be as convenient as the Metairie Cemetery, but I'll take it every time.
If you've been waiting for the right time to tackle your weight loss goals, this is it. Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the WeGovy pill and the WeGovy pen. The results are incredible, and it's an amazing and effective tool for you or those you care about. With WeGovy at Hers, you can lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, WeGovy is the first ever GLP-1 pill for weight loss. That means no needles. Everything is 100% online, and Hers connects you with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. Weight loss by Hers even goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutritional tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget. If eligible, you'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Are you ready to reach your goals? Okay, here we go. Visit forhers.com/war room to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/war room. Again, forhers.com/war room. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states, and WeGovy is a registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, WeGovy clinical study information and restrictions, visit forhers.com. The link is in our show notes. All right, now for our listener question. James, I want to start with a separate one, then we'll get to them. Leslie. Leslie doesn't tell us where she's from or where he's from, but what Leslie says is worth repeating. Leslie says, just wishing dear James a speedy recovery and return to tip-top health. We all love him, Al, and the show. Oh. Right on, Leslie.
Hey, Leslie. Well, I have good news to report. As most of you know, I had hernia surgery 3 weeks ago, yesterday, and I was able to get in and out of my car and in and out of my bed without that kind of staggering pain you get in your left groin. So I'm very encouraged for that. I don't fear having to get in the car. I mean, once I get in, I was fine, but now it doesn't hurt to get in. So that's my marker. We're having a good recovery. Thank you. And I'm going to go to my sisters are coming to South Mississippi tomorrow. So we'll have a good weekend.
Well, thank you, Leslie, for
thank you, Leslie. I appreciate your concern. Absolutely.
Sweet
at Alan I's age, no such, the definition of minor surgery is surgery on someone other than yourself.
Absolutely. James, our first question, apart from the wonderful Leslie, is it's similar. It's from Bob in San Diego, California, and Progressive Ken, wherever Ken's from. They say the tent is bigger than your vision. Why push a narrow focus on decentric moderation when it actively dampens the energy required to turn out voters and build a lasting coalition? I assume he's talking about the, you know, left wing.
Well, first of all, thank you. One of my favorite parts of the country is North San Diego County. It's gotten so, Yogi Berra's words, has gotten so crowded, it only goes there anymore. But it's a great place. I love my time when I was in the military in San Diego. This is the problem. You're right. You want to be as big a tent as you possibly. You want to be an inclusive party because if you are a Democrat, you do believe in inclusion. That's very pluralism and inclusion, a part of your ideal thoughts. However, and they do bring a certain level of energy. There becomes with any group or people who are on the ideological fringes, there comes a point where whatever they bring to you is not worth what they bring against you. And I know it sounds so stupid and everything, but you got to be for Thanksgiving. Okay. I mean, there's some things you got to like the flag. We can call a pretty wide strike zone. If you're against interracial dating, I'm not for it. I don't care. You're not part of my coalition. I don't want you in the fucking coalition. Now, who am I to, okay, there's no mechanism of which you can let people, it's not like a college sorority or something. You can let in people, you know, kick them out. But I think you want to have a broad coalition, but a broad coalition's limits can be tested, and we have to remember that.
Yeah.
By the way, some of these people will tell you they don't like the Democratic Party. They think it's co-opted evil, that it's no different than a Republican Party. Good. Don't be a Democrat. Don't use the word Democrat. If it's such a horrible thing, why don't you call yourself the Socialists of America? Or the Independent Socialists of America, or the Unaligned Socialists of America, whatever the fuck you want. Don't use the word Democratic in it.
Our next question comes from Kathy in Buffalo, New York, the hometown of the great Timothy J. Russert, whose son Luke had a baby last week. So the Russert clan will flourish for many, many years to come. Kathy says, assuming the Democrats win at least the House in November, what bill should they propose to set hard rules for things previously just accepted as agreed upon by unspoken rules? Kathy, you're a little bit in the weeds there. If they win the House, which I think they're going to do, they ought to pass legislation, which they know is unlikely to be enacted because of the Senate filibuster, even if Democrats win the Senate, or a Trump veto. But they ought to pass bills that, A, will set an agenda for them and help a 28 candidate and put Republicans on the spot. Raise the minimum wage. Repeal all the Medicaid cuts. Raise taxes on the very wealthy. Adopt very strict ethics rules that apply to Congress, the executive branch, and the Supreme Court. There may be a couple others, but that's the kind of agenda that I think will make Republicans uncomfortable, is responsible, and will help pave the way for a Democratic nominee 2 years or a year and a half later.
Well, this is 12 August, the year 2026. It's 12:20 Eastern Daylight Time. In my view, the Democrats will have 55 senators next January. I'll hold to that prediction unless I see something to the contrary. But right now, I certainly, like anybody else, reserve the right to revise it downward. Oh, I have to revise it upward from what I'm seeing, because every piece of evidence I see tells me it's going to be a monster year. I see no contrary evidence to that. Now, can it? And because things happen, of course, but let's be clear that what you say is true. If when the Democrats win the Senate back, if I were the Democratic leadership, I would tell my pollsters to give me five issues of things that are over 70% popularity and the Republicans can't be for it. Raising the minimum wage would be one example. How about raising taxes on wealthy people to take the money and put it in the first hometown buyer's mortgage relief fund? I guess going to poll 82%. Anything with big pharma is going to poll massively. And play, you're not going to be able to do anything because you know I don't think he can get to 67 Senate seats. Sorry. I don't know how many it would take 60. In the House, but we're not going to get there. Play hardball politics for 2 years. I mean, really hardball politics. Make them sweat, make them vote, investigate them, make them take every tough vote, make them walk every plank, and then you get a president in 2028. Then you let Puerto Rico and D.C. in as states, and you expand a Supreme Court to 13, and you move on with the future of this country. That's the plan.
Joni in Amherst, Massachusetts, who points out that she's not from the faculty lounge in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Yeah, a lot of faculty lounges in Amherst, Massachusetts, I can tell you that.
She said, is there a good resource that can help individual donors decide where their money can have the most impact? This is a question that's often asked. I'd love to know which competitive Democratic races are genuinely winnable and where the candidate is financially disadvantaged to really make a difference.
All right. I'm going to tell you what I think the best thing you can do. Listen to old episodes of this show. And listen to, and generally every week we have a Democratic challenger of some sort or another, or maybe sometimes we'll have an incumbent. And I got to just tell you, Al and I are just blown away by how talented these people are. You know, I really like the person in Western North Carolina. I really like
Jamie Agger.
Yeah, right. I really like the Tucson Marine Corps drill instructor. Okay,
She scared you a little bit, James.
Yeah, she does.
I mean, having that Marine Corps drill instructor. Okay. On.
Honestly, that's what I'd do. I would go back and look it up. You don't need 5 minutes to just look at the old segment and listen to some of these challenges, because in addition to give you good guidance on how to spend your money, it's going to restore your faith in the future of America. That's the most important thing. We cannot despair. There's talent. The Calvary is coming. It's coming.
Okay. John in Chicago says, can you predict what the MAGA turnout will be in the midterms? Will it collapse or be a strong turnout? Much more likely, collapse may be too strong a term, but it's going to be diminished. There is tension within the MAGA coalition. Trump's popularity has waned. And James, he's out there talking about the reflecting pool and the arch and the ballroom and, you know, his, you know, he had to, whatever that weird story was in Europe, where he had to sneak out of the plane and kind of hide in a little truck to go to a private plane. That may be totally justified on a security level, but he didn't level. He lied to people. So I think the Democratic turnout, largely based on the need for change and anti-Trump, is going to be very good. And I suspect a lower, much lower than they hoped for, MAGA turnout.
So since this program started, I've gotten two texts about Democratic turnout. Listen, G. Elliott Marks, so you listen to us? Because we like you. You've been on this show. We want to have you back.
You have been.
Do a piece about what have we learned thus far from primary turnout among Republicans and Democrats. And what does it historically mean? You're in a better position. I mean, of course, Wasserman could do it. But, you know, he's, you know, legendary. But there's a lot of people that are quite good at this. And I think it's a critical question. I hadn't seen the answer. Maybe it is out there. But, I mean, in Wisconsin last night, I think there were 300,000 more Democrats that showed up than Republicans. And I was a little bit more of a contested primary. I don't know what it means. You know, it's like we have the baseball scores. You know, 8-4, 2-1, you know, 6-3. Well, okay, what does that mean? And I would like some analysis of what this turnout means in these primaries and what's this historical relevance to Election Day.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's been true almost virtually every place across the board. Our next question is from Alan in Philadelphia.
Oh, wow.
Who says, Please help me understand the importance of the South Carolina presidential primary. This is for you, James. Granted that it samples the choice of Southern black voters, but South Carolina hadn't voted for a Democratic in a presidential election since 1976. Allen thinks it would be more practical to choose a candidate based on the outcome of the four or five swing states, which actually determine the outcome of presidential elections. James?
All right. Let me give you the argument for South Carolina. First of all, this all started back in, I guess it was 84 or 80, when we decided we're going to have a Super Tuesday primary. Then we're going to have all these states, most of them were southern states, and they would be determinative in the outcome of the election. And it's always been, since I can remember, it's always been an early New Hampshire primary. Then we came in, we had the Iowa caucuses, we had the Nevada caucuses, I guess, whatever they had. Now we got the Michigan primary. This is the single, listen to me very carefully, the single most loyal and important voting constituency in the Democratic Party, not close, are blacks. And this is a symbolic thing that they have in most of the people that are going to vote in the Democratic primary are going to be black. It is very important that their contribution and their wisdom be acknowledged and recognized by the larger Democratic Party. And I know we bring in a lot of people in, and this is great. The immigrant people, different experiences. We bring in young people we didn't have before. I understand all of that. But to all of you who come here and become Democrats, understand you are part of a political party whose most loyal and wisest demographic are black Americans. And South Carolina is symbolic. It chooses wisely. And it should remain in the forefront of really critical states in nominating a Democratic president. I think I'm making a point.
As you know, my view is South Carolina was really important when it was a cleanup hitter, and I still think that's the best position for him. I think that most rewards those loyal black voters down there, but we'll see. John in Sonoma, California asked, do centrist Democratic candidates need to have a sister soldier moment? You'll remember that, James, and attack AIPAC and Netanyahu to unite the party. They're already doing it, yeah. John, and they ought to do it more. AIPAC is a right-wing Republican organization that interferes in Democratic elections, often dishonestly. Ask Tom Malinowski in New Jersey, or ask the Democratic candidate in Evanston, Illinois, whose mother is Israeli, whose grandparents were Holocaust survivors, campaigned against. We saw it again this week. Any Democratic candidate in almost any district can be anti-AIPAC and anti-Netanyahu at no risk.
Well, the Tom Malinowski thing, I don't even know what the fuck were they doing. What was the game plan there? That had to be one of the stupidest political moves that you could imagine. And when that happened, and I know some of these guys, I know Bob Bass, and they're a smart guy, I don't think. You know, I don't know what happened. The AIPAC became an adjunct of the Republican Party and became, I think, a lot of their boards are more interested in things other than policies in the Middle East because they're not very sophisticated. I don't know why you take a guy like Tom out. I don't know why you wouldn't be put a Barack, Bill Clinton peace plan. I have no idea.
Well, they savaged Malinowski. You know what? They got a pro-Palestinian anti-Israel.
I don't understand it. Or at least to understand where they were coming from. I don't even see what the fuck they're doing now. I really don't.
Yeah. I don't
they're becoming less effective. And a Democratic candidate can beat up on them, but they're not even perceived in a lot of places they can come in and you know, in a place like St. Louis, and you had somebody like Cori Bush, who was really, I don't call anybody anti-Semite. That's not what I want to do.
Yeah.
She certainly was unfavorable to the state of Israel, to say the least. All right.
Yeah. Well, listen, let me tell you, we love those questions. Please keep sending them in. If we didn't get to them next week, or this week rather, we'll get to them next week. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Smalls, Aqua True, 3-Day Blinds, and HERS WL in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them. When you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go and take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.